So today, I'm going to talk about a subject which has been fascinating me over the last couple of years, and we're looking for sexy titles in the talks over the last week or two, and I came up with Supercomputers Meet the Ether, and I really do mean ether and not Ethernet, but the real official title is Fast Algorithms for Coulomb Interactions. Now, this is work that I've been performing in Paris with my graduate student, who's Vincent Rossetto. And the problem that I'm going to pose to you, and at least partially answer, is how do you calculate 1 over r if you're doing a simulation? There are many cases where you want to calculate 1 over r, such as the Coulomb interaction. And the only constraint that I want to have on it is that I want to do it quickly. And that actually makes it a lot harder. I'm going to show you that it drags us in to a whole series of problems of constraints and dynamics of constrained systems. And this sort of touches on some of the things that David was telling us a few days back. And the typical applications that I'm interested in are, for instance, how to write better molecular dynamics codes, how to do clever or faster Monte Carlo simulations. And I'm interested in doing that in rather large systems. People who work on charged systems work very often now with up to 10 to the 5 charged particles in a simulation. And to get through to this practical point, I realized that I didn't understand electrostatics, and I didn't understand Coulomb's law and where it came from, and I don't really understand Maxwell's equations very well either. And I hope to puzzle you at least as much. Okay, so as I said, there was a technical challenge, which I guess I learned about to a large degree talking with people like Ralph and other members of the Mainz group. And this is I'm sort of normally used to thinking about problems that come from experiments, but in this case, I think there are a number of nice statistical mechanics problems that you can get from talking to numericists. So for instance, there are people that do simulations on proteins. It's a very fashionable field. The most stupid way you would imagine if you're going to do Coulomb interactions is you say, well, I've got n particles in a box. Then clearly there are n squared pairs of interaction. And I just sum up the energies of all the particles. Well, that's actually rather bad if n is 10 to the 5. It means that calculating the energy, even for one single time step of your evolution, is an extraordinarily slow process. And that's why I said that the tricky thing in calculating 1 over r is doing it fast enough when you've got many, many interactions and many different particles. So how can you do better? There are a number of methods which are sort of the classical fast algorithms which can be applied to Coulomb interactions. There was a rather neat trick dreamt up by Peram and his collaborators in the 80s, which was a modification of the Ewald summation technique. You can go to fast Fourier transform and use FFTs on a grid to help you. And then there's a very popular method at the moment as well, which is called the fast multipole. So I'm going to resume those to give you a taste of what people are doing at the moment. Then I'm going to show you can do a constrained Monte Carlo trick. And I'm going to try and argue that it's perhaps more interesting than some of the other classical methods. And then I'm going to go on and tell you what the relation of what I have done is with things like the Maxwell equations. And if we have the time, we'll get to Fitzgerald's ether. Excuse me? No, you do your Monte Carlo algorithm or your molecular dynamics algorithm and you run at whatever temperature you want. Okay? People who do a simulation of a protein run it at 300 Kelvin.
Sure. And 700 people being fast multipole
is very basic systems. Well, that's why there are a lot of people trying to apply fast multipole to molecular dynamic simulations. I'm not too keen, but I expect you to defend the honor of the mathematical community. But, so I just want to put in some numbers and give you some ideas of time scales and length scales that people work on in these numerics. So as I said, 10 to the 5 particles rate typically. People are interested in polyelectrolytes, DNA, protein in a water solvent. Even water, one should think, is a charged system. When you do a molecular dynamics simulation of water, you actually distribute small partial charges all over the place. And a very common model is that to actually distribute 4 charges around. And there's a lot of work as well on two-phase behavior in charged systems, which is being a subject of interest in the more fundamental statistical mechanics community. Numbers, if you're trying to do some molecular dynamics, then you actually have to integrate everything, all the motions of the protein. And a number that you can have in mind is that the fastest modes in proteins are somewhere in the 10 femtosecond timescale, which means that if you're doing molecular dynamics, you actually have to take a time step which is considerably smaller than that, somewhere around a half a femtosecond. So to get out to 1 nanosecond, you need something like a million time steps. So you can work out, you know, if we're looking at proteins on nanometric timescales, and it takes picoseconds for the sound or a density fluctuation to travel. But already, many, many simulators are fantastically happy when they get to 1 nanosecond. This is considered as enormously long simulation. But you have to think that, for instance, ions are diffusing over a Debye length in something like tens of nanoseconds. So that very, very often, in these very large simulations of proteins and so on, even the basic electrostatic degrees of freedom are probably not equilibrated. One would want to go to hundreds of nanoseconds to get some reasonable calculation of what the electrostatics are doing, what the entropy of the counter ions is doing, and already doing 10 to the 4 atoms for a nanosecond on your sort of basic workstation is actually weeks of CPU time. Okay, so they're very, very big problems and tough to simulate. Perhaps I ought to say that there's another number which is useful to have in mind, is that if you do a simulation of a protein, there are lots of very complicated local potentials, which are very complicated, lots of parameters in them, and you would expect that they would actually take a lot of time to simulate. But this long-range part dominates entirely the evaluation of the energies and the forces, and so really 95% plus percent of CPU time spent simulating even very complicated models with very, very many parameters is really purely the Coulomb loop. Okay, so how can you improve these basic the basic stupid method of calculating 1/r between all the particles? There was a clever trick dreamt up, as I said, by Perham and his collaborators in 88, is that you take your charge, which I imagine is some delta function, and I write that this delta function is a delta function plus minus a Gaussian, plus a positive Gaussian. And what I do is I group these two terms, and I calculate the electrostatic interaction between these objects in real space, and then I take a second part and I do the calculation in Fourier space. Now clearly, if I've got objects like that which are neutral, then the electrostatic interactions are screened at large distances, and so there's a cutoff in the electrostatics. Maybe I should move this because it's being blown away. So the real space cost of calculating this part of the interaction scales like the number of particles times essentially the radius of the cutoff divided by the atomic size cubed. And the part in Fourier space, what you have to do is you actually have to sum out modes where 2 pi n over L goes as 1 over R. typically the width of the thing in Fourier space goes as 1 over the width in real space. And so the cost in Fourier space is, again, an n, which comes from the cost of one Fourier transform of the whole density of the system, times, now you have to do, essentially, n cubed evaluations of the Fourier transform. So this gives you an L over R, full cubed. And then you take the sum of these two terms and minimize with respect to R, and you find that R should go as the square root of L. And that actually gives you a total cost for evaluating the electrostatic energy, which is no longer in n squared. It's as n to the 3/2. Okay, so you've seen that you've improved the exponent from 2 to 3/2. The problem is that you've got these Gaussians, and you have to cut them off somewhere. So you have to go out to several sigma. And what happens is you get costs of several cubed over evaluations. And so this thing only becomes really interesting, really, for more than 1,000 particles or several thousand particles, just because you have a prefactor which is a little too large to be comfortable. The second popular method is what's called the fast multipole. This goes back to Barnes and Hutt, who were people in astrophysics. They were interested in simulating star clusters. And then it's been put in a more general setting and been put on much better mathematical basis by the Courant people. And there, essentially, you take your system, and you chop it up into blocks. So this big thing here is cut up into three blocks here, laterally and similarly in depth. And then you break it up again and again. And essentially, what you do is you calculate, rather than calculating the interaction between the individual particles, you calculate multipole moments at each level of block. And for instance, to calculate the energy between all the particles here and all the particles there, suffices to calculate the energy between the multipoles. And if you do this cleverly, these authors showed that you can actually get an algorithm which is linear in n. So we started off as n squared, we went down to n to the 3/2. It's linear in n, but there's an enormous coefficient. The value which is normally quoted is 189 p to the 4th, where p is essentially a logarithm of the error that you want to do. But unfortunately, it's only the logarithm to square root of 3. So typically, this means that where does this p to the 4th come from? I think you can get it very roughly by saying, well, if you go up to a certain level in multipole, you've got L squared contributions. If you've got blocks in two places, then essentially you have to sum over all L squared times L squared multipoles. And so people normally run this in molecular dynamics at very, very low accuracy. The typical value which is used for the accuracy in evaluating these multipoles is only 10 to the minus 6. And many of the codes that use this report numerical instabilities. One can imagine why is that if you run this at low accuracy and then calculate the forces, then the force that you would go back is not the same as the forces you go forward, because essentially you've changed blocks at some point. And that turns your, in principle, time-reversible molecular dynamics algorithm into some almost time-reversible thing, and that's known to produce all sorts of instabilities when you do numerical integration. So my suspicion is that this terrible law in p to the 4th, which forces people to run at very, very low accuracies, is causing some of these problems due to time reversal asymmetry. And so people claim that this is an interesting thing with more than 30,000 particles or figures in that ballpark. Okay, so the third classical method is essentially FFT. This goes back even further. I think originally it was developed by people in the plasma community. Goes back to Hawkwood and Eastwood. More recently, there are people like Darden who have used this method in proteins and have pushed the lattice method very, very hard. So the idea is you take your particles and then you interpolate them to a regular lattice. And typically, if you're doing an atomistic simulation, you lose a lattice which is about a half an angstrom. Now clearly by doing this lattice, you've made errors, but those errors are short range and you can calculate them. So there are short range corrective factors you build in to get rid of the artifact of the lattice. And that's an art which has been developed by these people, among others. And then you can just use fast Fourier transform to calculate, to essentially solve the Poisson equation. And then from the solution of the Poisson equation, you can calculate the forces acting on the particles. And so, for instance, this is useful for about things with more than 10,000 particles. And the scaling is an n log n. So essentially, you get an n log n coming from the fast Fourier transform. So what are the sorts of problems that one meets looking at these methods? There are many things you can't even do with them. This is, I'm indebted to Ralph Evers for some of these remarks. For instance, the non-uniform dielectric media, just by summing 1 over r between lots of particles, that won't give you what happens when you add inhomogeneous dielectric background. For instance, if you want to do a simulation of a polar fluid which is wetting some substrate in an air background, then you've got three different dielectric constants. And these classic codes really don't handle that very well. In the protein literature, rather than sometimes calculating what's happening with all these water molecules, people like using an implicit solvent where you just say, well, the water is behaving as if it's got a large dielectric background, and the protein is a smaller dielectric background, and can we get anything out of that? Again, you need to be able to do things well with non-uniform dielectric constants. The methods can be very difficult to implement on multiprocessor machines, particularly the fast Fourier transform method. And this is becoming more and more important. There are many groups building large multiprocessor setups to, for instance, simulate large molecules. And you want to be able to distribute the simulation on 1,000 processors and not to have to communicate globally. And for instance, FFT breaks down because at each stage you need to communicate lots of information between different processors. And the thing just, people don't know how to do it well. The methods only work for molecular dynamics. And sometimes one likes to do Monte Carlo. It's much easier to write. And there are stability criteria on Monte Carlo, which are really very, very nice. And again, finally, these things are still too slow. One spends all the time calculating 1 over r.
They're slow for Monte Carlo because you have to evaluate all...
Well, for instance, an FFT, you can't use the FFT method for Monte Carlo because you move one particle and you have to do the whole thing, and it's completely inefficient. You can't use that method. Now, in principle, you could probably adapt the method of the fast multipole. But you would get an extra log, at least, in the times. It would slow it down another factor of 10 compared with what it is already. There are other ideas around, well, had the field theorists done anything which is clever? And I spent some time trying to look into lattice gauge theories and so on. But it's not the same thing as what we want here, because they're interested in coupling the electrostatics or the electric field to the wave functions, and we're just interested in charge density, which is not the same thing. Maybe one can do something by integrating Maxwell's equations, and I'll come back to that later. And the thing that I spent a lot of time playing around with at the very beginning, and if you read the literature, I think many people have wished they could do something with this, is just to say, well, why don't we take this stupid functional, which is in Jackson? Then we know very well that we can find the electrostatic energy just by minimization of this functional over phi. But the problem is that you actually get minus the energy of the system when you do that. And you can't use that to simultaneously update the positions of the particles and the field. It's a minimization principle for the field with fixed particles, but you can't use it as a dynamic principle for moving the particles within a field. Okay, so this is the beginning of the trick.
Tony, can you expand that last remark? If it's a correct minimization for the field, can't you just use the hybrid method where you minimize, you use it just to minimize the field each step, and then you use the field to calculate deterministically what you do with the particles?
I spent a year trying to do that efficiently. And there are other people clearly who have tried it. There are people like Hansen, Jean-Pierre Hansen has tried that. People like Marsden, I think, in Oxford have tried that. And no one has got anywhere with it. Now, I'm going to show you that maybe there are other ways. I really learned that it wouldn't work by reading, in fact, the first chapter of the Feynman book on gravitation. And in the first chapter of the Feynman book on gravitation, there's a discussion on how to know the tensor structure of gravitation. And essentially, he starts out with a scalar theory and shows that maybe, and then electromagnetism, the sign of the interaction is wrong. Two light charges repel. Then a tensor theory, again, it's the right sign. So there's an alternation of signs as a function of L, essentially, in coupling particles to a field. And it's clearly you have to work with a vector theory, and just reducing it to a scalar potential is always going to give you the wrong sign. That's what I learned from that book. So essentially the thing to do is to write that the energy is essentially the integral of the electric field squared, E. Okay, that's something we all know. And the constraint comes in is because I'm going to say I'm only going to allow configurations of the electric field E which satisfy Gauss's law. So what I'm going to do is create a variational functional E squared upon 2 and some Lagrange multiplier phi which multiplies the constraint. Now if I minimize this, I actually find that E is grad phi. And then I substitute back in, and I find indeed that the Coulomb energy is plus grad phi squared, but without the rho phi that I had on the previous transparency, with phi solution of the Poisson equation. But this is, I emphasize the point, that this comes out as minus the energy of the minimization over phi of this functional. Okay, so this is the way to flip the sign, by saying that rather than minimizing this functional alone, one should minimize that with a constraint. So that's the zero temperature problem. Now this is essentially the crucial transparency to understand what goes on at finite temperatures. What I'm going to do is take the constraint dV equals rho and the energy is 1/2 E squared. And I'm going to write that I can express the electric field as firstly a part which is a gradient of phi, where phi is just the solution of the Poisson equation, as I showed you before, plus some completely arbitrary piece, which is the curl of some function, theta. Okay, so that's the general solution to this constraint equation. Okay, because I take the divergence of a curl, and it's zero. Now there's perhaps an interesting way of looking at that, which I've written at the bottom, is that you can write in Fourier space that E is equal to minus k phi plus k vector product with theta. And this is clearly two transverse degrees of freedom. And if you want, you can think of them as photons. Okay, so I've got the longitudinal field, which is coming from the scalar potential phi, and two transverse degrees of freedom, which are photons, which correspond to the theta field.
The third line is a solution to the...
So this is the solution, general solution to the constraint equation.
But the curl is... And, if you minimize U, it'll give you a value.
Okay, this is the solution to the constraint equation. Okay. I've not yet put it into the energy. Okay, that's the next line.
Could you think of a time derivative of the vector potential?
You can think of this if you wish, but that's going to come a lot later, and you don't. The advantage is not thinking of it like that. So you substitute this thing here into the energy, you get clearly the direct terms grad phi squared, cal theta squared, and you would think also that in general you should get a term in grad phi cal theta, but by integration by parts you can show this is zero.
What is theta? U?
Theta?
Theta is U?
Where's theta? There, there's theta. Theta is an arbitrary vector field. Which you can think of as describing photons, if you wish. U is the energy.
Oh, you have theta, okay.
U is the energy here, which is the integral of 1 half e squared, okay? So the cross term disappears. So if we now look at the partition function is the integral over all e to the minus beta times the energy. And I'm going to integrate over all electric fields consistent with the constraints. I'm not going to say I'm only looking at the minimum of this functional. I'm going to integrate all over all degrees of freedom. And there's a little miracle that happens because if I use this decomposition, essentially I get one part, which is the grad phi term, and one part, which is the curl term. And the only integral that is left over to do is the integral over the curl part. And given that this is the solution of Poisson's equation, all the charges, all the information on the charges is here, and this is just a constant. This is just a Gaussian integral, and is completely independent of the positions of the charges in the system. That means that I've got a partition function, which is the Coulomb partition function, times some constant. And essentially, my statistical mechanics is unchanged if I do this trick, if I consider a field which has both the normal longitudinal degree of freedom, phi, and these transverse photons, theta.
You don't necessarily know what's meant by that integral over theta just yet because it mathematically is just a function that could be present and still satisfy your constraint.
Yeah, you don't know. It's some arbitrary constant, and I don't need to know what it is.
And
is what I'm going to say.
You don't know other physical constraints that it might satisfy. So you shouldn't think of that as an integral over all possible function theta.
Why?
Why?
It's some constant. It's just some. So it's the this is the important transparency, and all the understanding is in this transparency. So it's sort of.
How do you know it doesn't depend on the charge distribution?
Because all the charge distribution is here.
Yes, but you introduce some arbitrary function.
Yeah.
Which can depend on.
But this arbitrary function is completely arbitrary and does not depend on where the charges are.
But may choose it such that.
Yeah. Well, I integrate all over all theta, independent of where the charges are.
The question is, I've named it my practice, whether this is a physical process. It ought to be if you're calculating the partition function.
Yeah.
Or just, I mean, really.
I would argue it is I'd argue it is a physical process in the sense that we're in a room where there are photons everywhere, and Coulomb's law is still true. Okay, we've got two charges, and Coulomb's law is true even when you turn the light on. Coulomb's law is not only true when you turn the light off. As the talk goes along, you'll see more and more that it's close to a photon.
And you quantize gravity, electricity by introducing this?
Okay.
So just one little bit.
Yeah.
Could it tell us that the measure doesn't matter because it's independent of particle positions? It wasn't clear what measure to take for either E or
anything. I'm going to argue that it doesn't matter in this simple case. When there are inhomogeneous dielectric inclusions, then the measure does matter. And that actually gives you an interaction in 1 over r to the sixth. But to calculate that correctly, you have to get the measure right. But in what I'm going to present today, the measure doesn't matter.
Can you put the equation first?
when you are integrating over phi and theta separately, you have the degeneracy because, I mean,
oh, agreed. That's where the constant. That's right. You count each state multiple times, but that's the constant. You just multiply your partition function by a constant. That's the trick. That's the whole idea. No, but you don't care because if you just multiply a partition function by a constant, then you essentially weight all the states the same way, and so all correlation functions are the same. Okay.
But in the integral over
graph I square,
where are the charges?
As I argued on the previous transparency, phi here is the unique solution to the Poisson equation. And so all the charges are in here implicitly, because this is the phi that I got from solving the Poisson equation.
Okay.
And since it's a unique, it comes out of the integral. So now, inspired by what people do in interpolating charges on the FFT, what I'm going to do is introduce a model on a lattice and try to persuade you that it's an implementation of the trick you saw in the previous transparency, and then I'll show you some numerics to show that it works. So the idea is that we want to conserve Gauss's law, and we're going to write Gauss's law in this form. Essentially, it's the integral form, that the flux coming out of a closed surface is always equal to the enclosed charge. So what I'm going to do is take a network point, and I imagine that I've got flux coming out of each of these links, and I've got a charge here. And now one of my Monte Carlo moves is going to be, I'm going to take the charge which is here and put it there. Now, what do I have to do to conserve the constraint globally? What I have to do is simply modify the E linking these two sites in the following way. I take E, capital E, electric field, and I take off the charge. And by doing that, I reduce the amount of flux coming out of this site by little e. And I increase the flux going into this site by little e. And I conserve the constraint at both lattice sites. Okay, so I've managed to update the constraint by using a single update on a single link after moving a particle. Okay. Now, I've got other ways that I can locally modify things while conserving Gauss's law. The other thing I can do is I can take a plaquette and I add a rotational motion. So I add a constant amount in this direction on each link, then clearly I've got more coming in here, but I've got more going out. So again, I conserve Gauss's law. Okay, so I've got two moves. This one is essentially integrating over the theta degrees of freedom. This one is moving your particles. And I do Monte Carlo with a random mixture of these two moves using the energy E squared. So that's the algorithm. And my claim is it's an implementation of what I said on the previous transparency, that you conserve always Gauss's law, you integrate over all the thetas, and by construction you must get the Coulomb partition function multiplied by a Boring constant.
So if you had a pure Coulomb gauge,
that's right,
one particle, the constraint that the field be purely longitudinal makes the field, you move a particle in one place, it disturbs the field everywhere. But
yep.
You're saying this is implicitly some gauge, or some gauge where you change the field only locally.
Gauge is potentials, and you're saying field and gauge in the same sentence. You're mixing two concepts.
Well, but your freedom to...
But my derivation was actually implicitly in the Coulomb gauge, because I had a phi which satisfied Poisson's equation, and it always instantaneously satisfies Poisson's equation after motion of a particle. So I'm actually doing exactly what I normally do in the Coulomb gauge. But we know very well that the Coulomb gauge is non-physical in the sense that I move an electron in this room, then at the other side of the universe, the potential changes in the Coulomb gauge.
Okay.
instantaneously. So it's a non-local gauge. And is a very bad gauge for thinking physically about what is happening.
What you're doing is a little bit, I mean, you don't have any dynamics, right?
Not for the moment, right. No. So I have, I'm going to use these two things as Monte Carlo moves.
So if you're solving a static
with a Metropolis problem, algorithm, yeah.
If you were solving a purely static problem, then real Coulomb gauge would just be the first term. It wouldn't have the vector.
Yeah, but that's why I call it photons, you see, because it is very much like the A field in the Coulomb gauge, which is purely transverse. In the Coulomb gauge, one has div A equals zero, which you can impose by saying that it's a curl of something. So actually, my presentation on the previous transparency is very much in the Coulomb gauge. Gauss's law.
Gauss's law.
Yeah.
Fine.
I move one particle, charge. And I only have to modify one single link to get the constraint imposed again. And that's what's interesting, because normally if you have to do a solution of the Poisson equation, you move one particle, and you have to satisfy Poisson's equation everywhere. So what I've done in doing this is I've got the exact phi in my system by construction, and I've excited something else. I've excited these theta fields. So if originally I had an initial condition which had theta equals zero everywhere, then I've got some theta non-zero due to the motion of this charge. And what I showed you was that if you integrate over all thetas, yes, it doesn't change statistical mechanics. So I'm going to add this extra move here, and by having these moves together with the Metropolis algorithm, then I have a realization of this partition function that I wrote on the previous transparency.
So you're never proposing to solve Poisson's equation?
That's the whole idea, is to stop getting rid of Poisson's equation. Just don't do it, yes. Just say no. Okay, so the first thing to check was, well, I did a number of checks. Firstly, I just annealed. I took some random set of charges and I anneal the thing at zero temperature, and I see that my algorithm converges to the solution of the Poisson equation. That's a good thing. The second check was that I actually took a Poisson solver and this local update algorithm and ran two series of simulations where I calculate the structure factor for a very, very small system so I can get very, very good statistics. And essentially, they're identical to within the errors. So the simulations on very small systems are giving identical results if you use this new method and you use a classical Poisson solver. So that's a reassuring me that I'm not perhaps doing something too stupid. If I look at bigger systems, because here there are lots of squiggles and it's very bumpy, this is just artifact due to the lattice. Okay, so this is only a 5x5 lattice or something like that. Or 5x5x5, it's three dimensions. So I took a bigger lattice, took a larger number of charges, several thousand, I think, 5,000 perhaps. And what I actually do is look at the structure factor for a larger system. Now, if you believe electrostatics and so on, you expect to get screening. Screening means that you've got Lorentzians in your density-density correlation functions in Fourier space. So if you plot 1 over this as a function of q squared, essentially you should get a straight line. So that's actually what's plotted here. I plot 1 over s as a function of 1 over q, and I get a reasonably good straight line. So it's showing me that my algorithm is producing correlations, which are what you expect. The screening length is related to the slope of this curve. I've not measured it.
What's giving rise to this screening?
This is a Debye screening.
Oh, oh,
okay, this is the Debye screening length. Okay, so this is, if you look in Debye-Huckel.
This is a neutral plasma.
This is a totally, the algorithm will only work for a totally neutral system. I can't have free charge excess. Okay, So this is 5,000 charges, half positive, half negative, in a 25 cube box, I think. Okay, so that's a demonstration that the method seems to be giving the right result. Then there's a question of efficiency. I can imagine, well, I've coupled this extra field, and it's Gaussian, and maybe it's going to slow things down, and maybe there's going to be some sort of strange critical coupling between density fluctuations and field fluctuations, which means that the thing looks clever, but it's just slow. And so a plot that one can make as well is the scaling of simulation time with system size. So what I've done here is varied the system size from something like 6 cubed to 36 cubed. And I look at the relaxation time for density-density fluctuations and the relaxation time for charge-charge fluctuations. And what I find is that the relaxation time scales in the linear system size squared. So this is exactly what you'd expect if you had diffusion. I've got my particles going around in the system. If there were no interactions at all between the particles, I would expect to get this curve or this line, a slope of 1, or saying that relaxation time in, measured in sweeps is quadratic in the system size. So that's saying that I'm not getting any strange couplings which are slowing me down. The other thing that's nice is you see that the charge-charge fluctuations have a relaxation time which saturates with the system size, and this is because charge fluctuations relax by diffusion on the Debye length. Okay, so this is telling you how long it takes to diffuse over the Debye length, and this is why you get a relaxation time for electric degrees of freedom, which is independent of the system size. It's very close to the idea of a plasmon, exactly. Okay, so that's the basic numerics. I want to now go on and do some slightly more fundamental stuff to try and argue what the continuum equations are obeyed by this algorithm, and we're going to get closer and closer to Maxwell as this goes on. So this is the kinematics of what's going on. So for instance, when I said earlier on that I take my particle, I move it from 1 to 2, and I should change E12 to E12 minus E. Well, I'm going to take the derivative of that, and I'm going to say that the derivative of the field due to sources is just minus the current. Okay? So if I put lots of charges down this link, then the field should evolve more quickly. So again, I say I've got these theta fields, and I'm going to look at two adjacent plaquettes and look at fluctuations in the field in the connecting link 1, 2 due to fluctuations in these two theta fields. And what I see is that if I modify these two thetas, that the modification of the E in the Y field is due to the difference to the modification of the Z, of the theta in the Z direction. And if I write that in terms of components, that's saying to me that the fluctuation of E is the derivative of theta Z with respect to X. And I'm going to recognize that this is actually a component of the curl operator. Okay? So if I combine this and this, it tells me that the time variation of the E field is minus J plus the curl of theta dot. Now, if I write that H is equal to d theta by dt, I actually find one of the Maxwell equations. Yeah? Sorry, I said earlier on that I was going to integrate over these rotational degrees of freedom in the plaquette. Where was that? I said that I could add a rotation in a plaquette. And so what I'm doing now is I say, well, so this would add, for instance, some delta E. Okay, so I just look at, now, I just modify this plaquette by a theta ZA and this plaquette by a theta ZB, and look at the resultant difference on the E12. I do that, it gives me this difference because this thing goes round and up here, but this one goes round and down on this link. So I get the difference between these two theta fields. When I do that, and if I write that H is equal to theta by dt, and I'm going to argue that's a good thing to do later, then I get the Maxwell equation, and that this recipe for updating the links is none other than the Maxwell displacement current. The big thing that, why do we call Maxwell's equations the Maxwell's equations? It's because he took the relation between curl H and J, which was previously known, and added a derivative of E. And this strange rule of modification of a link as a charge moves down it, this E goes to capital E goes to capital E minus little e, is the Maxwell displacement current. So that's the kinematics of what's going on. We can get another equation linking things by looking at some energetics. So again, I'm going to take a plaquette, and I've got these fields on each link surrounding the plaquette, and I'm going to look at the fluctuation delta of this rotation and calculate the couple. So I've got this field, which I'm now going to, I'm going to start thinking of it as something that's spinning with some angular velocity. And I'm going to calculate the couple on this theta degree of freedom, which is spinning on the plaquette. And if I do that, what I have to, well, there are a couple of, there's a square missing in the first term. So the energy that I'm using is the sum over the lengths of E squared. I write this out. For instance, this plaquette here, the EX41, I add a delta, whereas the EX43, I've got too many Y's and not enough X's. It's an EX32. So for instance, the delta comes in at a different, with the opposite sign here and here, due to the orientation of these plaquettes compared with the rotation. I take this derivative, and I get, again, a difference between the two EX components and the two EY components. And again, I recognize this as a couple, which is just the curl of the electric field. This is components, the Z component of the curl operator. And so if I'm doing Monte Carlo, I know that the evolution of the system is essentially a Langevin equation, with the driving force coming in on the right-hand side, and so that the Langevin equation, which is sort of the continuum limit of what I'm looking at, is that some friction coefficient times the angular velocity is minus curl E. So I essentially have the two major equations, one of them the Maxwell equation, one of them essentially the relaxation equation. I drop the friction coefficient and the noise. I can combine these, and this actually gives me a diffusion equation for the electric field. So the electric field diffuses, and it has two source terms. It has a source term, which is the gradient of the density, the charge density, and a second source term, which is the electric current. Now, if I'm in the static limit, I can drop this, and what's left is essentially a derivative of Poisson's equation. So the static limit of this equation incorporates Poisson's equation, and I can take the divergence of this equation, and I can see that essentially div E minus rho satisfies a diffusion equation, so that if I put div E minus rho 0 at the beginning, it remains 0 for all times. And I actually see that I've implemented the Gauss's law as an initial condition on the dynamic equations, okay, And this should actually remind you perhaps of quantum mechanics. For instance, if you do Dirac quantization of the electromagnetic field, then you know that you implement the Gauss's law not as an operator equation, but as an initial condition on your wave function. And you only choose, you actually have a complete arbitrary choice for wave functions, and you can choose div E minus rho, whatever you want, in quantum electrodynamics. And you only choose it equal to zero as an initial condition. So the same thing is actually coming out of this Monte Carlo algorithm.
One thing that worried me when I saw the Boxer equation is that if you ever had an electric field that didn't satisfy Poisson's equation, it would only relax diffusively. You'd have to diffuse across the whole system. You said I should not worry that because it satisfies Poisson's equation at every step.
It satisfies the Gauss's equation at every step. Doesn't solve the E has always got longitudinal and transverse components. The longitudinal component is always a solution of Poisson's equation.
Okay. You have to start something.
And you have to start with.
Sorry, what happens to the wave equation if this smaller than something else, shouldn't I recover?
Propagative electrodynamics, another three transparencies.
Well, actually, this thing does decay, this difference in brackets in the Boxed equation does decay.
This thing here?
Yeah, so that has some value in thermal equilibrium of the systems. If I get the charges still, and I let the electric field relax with this dynamics, I'm trying to figure out, is this in dynamics to completely explore the fluctuations of the electric field that's diffusive and slow as a result?
Diffusive isn't next transparency. So to understand the simulations that I showed you early on a little better, you can couple the equations from the previous transparency with some simple transport equation. So you can, for instance, take an electric current locally, which is a gradient of a concentration, times some electric field, and just solve. So this is like doing a sort of Drude model of a metal, coupling essentially a fundamental equation, which is the electrodynamic equation, to some phenomenological equation for the charges. And if you do that, you get a diffusion equation for the particles, and you get, for instance, for either the charge or the longitudinal component of the electric field, you get essentially this equation that the diffusion operator picks up a mass, and this is just linked to the Debye length. Okay, and the same thing happens with the transverse components of the field. So, and this is your plasmon remark that essentially as T is very large. If you go to Fourier space, you go look at omega, then essentially you get a dispersion law which has got a gap in it. And so to cross-check that, we did some simulations, for instance, where we measure the S of Q of T. We fit them. So this is S of Q of T, where both for the density-density correlation function and the charge-charge correlation function that's measured in the points. We fit them to a single exponential, and then I plot the results. So the decay times as a function of Q, so decay rate as a function of Q, so for density-density correlation functions and charge-charge correlation functions. So this is just diffusion, omega goes to Q squared, and the charge-charge density correlation has a gap. Omega goes to goes like a constant plus Q squared. And the fact that it's got a gap is a consequence of screening. And that's what gave you this saturation in the relaxation time in the measure of dynamics as a function of system size.
Different diffusion.
Well, no, actually, the longitude, this one is actually the same. Well,
slopes
the slopes are different. Yeah, that's right.
That doesn't mean there's no decay
of charge correlations for an infinite system?
No, it says that for an infinite system, the charge correlation function dies away in a time which is independent of the system size. And physically, this is something you know, that you only have to rearrange ions locally in a Debye length to screen electric fields in a charged solution. So that's essentially what's going on here. And that's something which is preserved by this algorithm. Still, things remain very local, and which is not preserved by all the classical algorithms, where you move something and you actually have to re-update everything globally all the way to infinity because you solve Poisson's equation or do something similar by using multipoles. Okay, so I got the I showed you the case of the Monte Carlo algorithm. What happens if we try to put a propagative dynamics on the electric field? So what I'm going to do is preserve this Maxwell equation, which is essentially which I call the sort of the kinematic constraint on these variables theta, E, and J. And before I had a couple which was curl E, and rather than using a relaxational dynamics, essentially a Langevin equation, I'm going to say, well, there's going to be some angular momentum associated with a theta field, and so I'm going to have sort of dp by dt, which is equal to d2 theta dt squared, an acceleration term, which is given by this couple. If I bring back my h is equal to d theta by dt, then essentially I have both the dynamic Maxwell equations. Okay, so you implement this idea of constraints locally, and you turn it into a propagating dynamics, and essentially you automatically get the Maxwell equations out. I'm using an a-dimensional form. Okay, so I've taken away the epsilons and the mu's. For the moment, you can take the speed for as whatever you want. That's actually an interesting question. I've not got the end. That's still something I'm thinking about. Okay, so we're almost to the end of the story. I just want to make one final diversion, which is something I've been learning the last week or so, and getting us to the ether. But before getting to the ether, I want to talk about gears. So, back to Maxwell, back to Fitzgerald. Okay, so take two gears, two wheels which have to roll one against the other without slipping. And I'm going to take a Lagrangian for them, and take the Lagrangian, which is the angular velocity squared. I'm going to have potentials G and H acting on the two wheels, and there's a constraint. Well, it depends on. That's giving me the sign of my coordinate system, and the constraint is that phi dot plus psi dot is equal to zero. Okay? So I'm going to put a constraint in, and I'm going to call the Lagrange multiplier A. And I do my normal thing. I calculate my P's, and I calculate the equation of motion from the Lagrangian. And if I write down that a Hamiltonian, I find something which is quite fun. I find, for instance, that the Hamiltonian contains things like P minus A. In addition, I look at the equation of motion of phi, and it looks like a gradient of something, and a time derivative of A, time derivative of a vector potential. Okay, so one sees that classical electrodynamics is quite close to the motion of a set of gears. Okay, and this is where the ether comes back. So what do I have to do to turn my picture of spinning thetas with constrained E's and J's into real electrodynamics? What I can do is write down the following Lagrangian density now. I have theta dot squared, just my angular velocities of my theta field. I've got an energy, a potential energy now, which is E squared. And I've got the kinetic energy of my particles. And I'm going to impose a kinematic constraint, That's why I was calling it a kinematic constraint earlier on, that essentially E dot is linked to J plus curl H. And that's classical electromagnetism. It's classical electromagnetism, in fact, in a version which was discovered by Fitzgerald. And Fitzgerald's vision of this is you take wheels, it's no longer gears, and around each neighboring pair of wheels, you put an elastic band contains a stress E. And in fact, you write down the dynamical equations corresponding to an interlocked set of wheels and elastic bands, and you get the Maxwell equations. And this was an analogy dreamt up by Fitzgerald, and was in fact enormously important historically, because one has to understand that after Maxwell created his equations, they were quite obscure. Maxwell essentially worked with potentials in the Coulomb gauge, which is a non-local gauge, and the relation between what was happening locally and radiation and so on was not at all understood. Fitzgerald spent some time trying to calculate the radiation due to fluctuation charges, and he actually came up with an answer which was zero. And he seemed to have a theorem that charges could not radiate electromagnetic radiation. He came up with this mechanical analogy, and this mechanical analogy was close enough to what Rayleigh was up to in all his acoustics. And Rayleigh had developed a whole series of tools for calculating things like radiation and fields from vibrating mechanical objects. So Fitzgerald calculated the power in this mechanical analogy using the Rayleigh methods, and then just transposed his results back to the Maxwell equations. And this was the first calculation of power emitted due to fluctuation charges, for instance. And it came through this mechanical analogy. It might still be useful, because I think this vision of what's going on allows you to think of going on to building a molecular dynamics version of this Monte Carlo algorithm. I think it gives you an intuition about how to build code, which is still very useful. And the obvious thing that one would do is, when you do molecular dynamics, very often you want to couple things to a thermostat. And the obvious thing is to use this theta dot variable, this angular velocity, and couple that directly to a thermostat and equilibrate that thermally. But I'm still working my way through things like the Heaviside Fitzgerald-Lorentz contraction and so on, and whether that messes up things too much to be able to produce a reasonable molecular dynamics algorithm. So that's something I'm working on still. Thank you.
If you put in, so when you say couple theta dots, so in other words, you put in a stochastic.
That's right. On the magnetic field.
Yeah. Will that screw up this? You said you have to start with something that satisfies Gauss's law.
There are two. There's div b equals zero and div e equals rho. Now for us, we don't care if div b equals zero. In fact, I think maybe, this is very, very speculative, that by getting rid of div b equals zero, one might be able to get rid of all this contraction stuff. But that's something which is extraordinarily speculative, and maybe I'll change my mind on next week. So this is really at the limits of what I understand.
But div
e equals rho and div b equals zero are two independent consequences of this equation. And one could imagine getting rid of one of them and not the other. For instance, if you put, you can write down stupidly the equations, adding the theta dot coupling to a heat bath, and it does not violate Gauss's law. Okay. Gauss's law is still maintained even in that case.
Sorry. You probably said, but I forgot. What's the density of the charges that you actually use in your simulation? Is it one charge per two sites?
It was 1 in 6 or something like that I used. But it was a completely arbitrary number just to cross, to check that the code worked. Later, I hope we're going to do some real physics with it. When the code is really understood and working completely, then I hope to use it. I think it there are good chances that it's a couple of orders of magnitude faster than the classical algorithms.
Well, but of course, if the charge's density go down,
yeah,
then you need to increase over larger.
That's true. That's true. There's clearly a point.
At some point, there is a crossover.
Clearly, there's some point where this no longer is useful, and you should go over to multiple methods. But I would maintain that the very interesting cases, the very big simulations, always have water in them. And water is charged. It's globally neutral, but it's actually simulated by a set of separated charges. So in fact, the cases you're interested in are always densely charged systems, or at least in many of these. If you're interested in atomistic simulation, if you're interested in general statistical mechanics of a very simple model of polyelectrolytes, then maybe you don't want to put all the water charges in. But for atomistic simulation, I think you're always in the limit of large charge densities.
What's the potential in this from moving around fractional charges, right? I mean, you don't have any, there's nothing here that would constrain you to.
You always have to keep locally charge neutrality.
Yeah, but you can move fractional.
Oh yes, there's nothing that tells me that E's are a whole. I can split charges and move pieces of charges around and things like that. That's certainly true.
Presumably an algorithm like this would be easier to parallelize as well as it's local.
It's local. No, that's I think that's one of the big advantages of it. Not only on a single processor machine, it's much simpler to write and it's probably much faster. That for instance, the fast Fourier methods, no one knows how to put it on a multiprocessor machine, and this is essentially trivial. So that's looking forwards over 2 or 3 years, I think this will be a very big advantage of this method.
In your books, you used a combination of single charge exchange and this rotation, and how do you distribute the weight?
At the moment, I just stochastically do one or the other, and I've changed the weights.
50-50?
No, I've changed the weights. Well, Metropolis tells you essentially that you can choose the weights whatever you want, and you get the same.
It's zero, then you have.
Oh yeah.
Okay, it's not zero.
Yeah. Okay, but I've changed them by a factor of 20 from sort of 0.05 to 0.95, and the algorithm works very well. In fact, you can get away with very, very few updates on the field. The original way I was running it was with one update per degree of freedom, equally distributed per degree of freedom. Whereas in fact, you can get the thing to go much faster and equilibrate much more easily if you do many more particle movements. And that's essentially because the charge equilibrates locally, whereas the density correlation functions, you actually have to diffuse the whole distance. You're actually biased because of that towards motion of particles rather than motion of field.
Does it still apply for the charges having internal constraints, if they are, for instance, all at the same distance on the decay process?
That I've not thought about.
So can we look at the accuracy of the code? I mean, you compare it to things like fast multimodal.
Yeah.
When somebody writes a new numerical algorithm, they say not only has it scale with the number of particles, but also with the accuracy you want.
I would say that's
space.
Yeah.
You haven't shown us what
that's why I spoke of the FFT methods, because that's a solved problem. There is a short range correction, which has been worked out by the people that use FFT, and that's the same. Because essentially, the discretization I use has the same statistical mechanics as what the people who use the FFT has. So I can use their methods for correcting the errors in the grid. And that's a known.
Okay, or you could compare it to an exact solution and scale it as delta x gets small and see how.
Yeah, but they do fairly sophisticated things, and it works rather well. But I didn't want to get into all the details of that. That's sort of messy computer bookkeeping, but it's solved computer bookkeeping. Yeah, the standard code you can get off the web that does that.
It's interesting that you derived screening, because essentially what you did was just like in hydrodynamics, instead of using your scene tensor, just solving the fluid equations.
Yep.
So you derive screening. So this gets back to a conversation that's been had somewhere in the Institute of Transportation.
information about screening powers.
Yeah.
Because you could do this with powers, right? Instead of integrating one over R.
That's right.
Instead of using one over R, you just solve the solution.
Yeah, there's one in, when you say hydrodynamics, there's one interesting remark that I should make. If I turn the sources off of my dynamic equation for the diffusion of the electric field, I actually have the dynamic Stokes equation. And so I'm actually solving the dynamic Stokes equation, not the Navier-Stokes, just the Stokes part, while doing this. So there may be some thought of how to turn this into an efficient low Reynolds number hydrodynamic solver. Yeah, there's some interesting errors almost, I think, in the Stokes equation. In that, we know that between real electrodynamic particles, there's this 1 over r to the 6 interaction. And you write down the Stokes equations, and you would seem to also get a hydrodynamic static hydrodynamic interaction, which goes as 1 over r to the 6th. And there have even been papers, I think, published by some Russians, I forgot the name, who've claimed that this is true, that hydrodynamics give at finite temperatures, and the Stokes equations give you 1 over r to the 6th interactions generated hydrodynamically. I think this is probably wrong. And I think it's probably due to all these stories of constraints and what are the real degrees of freedom, and that going from atoms with potentials and incompressibility to the Stokes equations, I think we've probably introduced a determinant of the form that David was talking about, and which is not normally put in the Stokes equations. So I think there are some real subtleties in the dynamic Stokes equations at finite temperature, which I don't know how to attack.
The same as the tension. Right? It's enforcing inextensibility the same way the tension is enforcing.
Yeah, yeah. But you could, as we learned, this can sometimes introduce non-intuitive extra potentials.
Pressure.
No, extra determinants and things like that. And they may actually be needed to get a completely consistent treatment of the Stokes limit at finite temperature.
Right, so in order to understand the relation of this to normal methods, so one difference is that, as you said, you don't solve Coulomb's. All the other methods basically say I have fixed particle positions and I completely solve the Coulomb equation at that time step. Okay, so whereas you're doing your integral over the E field and the integral of the particle position simultaneously. So a worst case might be, suppose I tried to use this to solve a static problem.
Yep.
That is, suppose I put down charges, I didn't know the solution to Poisson's equation, and I wanted to use this as a method to figure out what the average electric field was.
Yeah.
by integrating over this axial field.
Yeah. It would work, but it would be slow.
It would be slow.
Okay. So it would be the stupid thing to do.
Right.
This is built to co-evolve the electric degrees of freedom and all the other degrees of freedom.
But there must be some criterion about when this is a good idea. Basically, it says that the electric field has to diffuse faster than other degrees of freedom in the problem. If the electric field ever depends on your choice of
factors. Well, the thing, if you've got free charges, you get this extra win because you've got the screening. And you only ever have to diffuse as far as the Debye length.
For the charge, but for the density, as you said, the density still diffuses normally.
Yeah. There's another point, in fact, that I think there's going to be a change in the relative interest of molecular dynamics and Monte Carlo as people go to longer simulations. If you're doing a very short simulation, which still takes an enormous amount of computer effort, you've only got picoseconds, and you want to at least get the energy roughly right. Now, typically what happens is you scrunch up your protein or your system into some horrible density state, and it springs back very quickly. And molecular dynamics is very good at relaxing these propagative modes, these sound waves, these density waves. But that doesn't mean you're in equilibrium. even in a simple fluid. For instance, we were speaking the other day about vorticity diffusion, that even in a simple fluid, there are slow hydrodynamic modes around which are diffusing. If you've got multiple species around, they are diffusing as well. And to simulate those degrees of freedom, you're going to have to wait that they diffuse no matter what you do. And so Monte Carlo is actually very good at moving those degrees of freedom around. And by the time they've moved around, your density has also relaxed in Monte Carlo. So I think some of the optimization ideas that molecular dynamics is the best thing to do for relaxing degrees of freedom is somewhat linked to the fact that people are in the 10, 100, maybe even 1,000 picosecond scale. And once you go much, much longer in time scales, if you want to go and look at relaxation of dye layers and so on, you probably get better result if you go to Monte Carlo. Questions?
I'm telling you, this was to push you on something. Don't give the other talk, but could you say a little bit about the Van der Waals interaction?
It's not Van der Waals.
It's not
Van der Waals. Okay, there are three ways of getting 1/r^6. There's Van der Waals, which is quantum. And this is a purely classical thing. And so you can't get Van der Waals out of this method. The other ways are typically, for instance, you take two dipoles, two permanent dipoles, and you thermalize them. Now, in any one configuration, there's an interaction 1/r³. But when you actually average over all conformations, that gives you a resulting 1/r^6. Okay, and that's an 1/r^6 that gets screened twice as fast as normal electrostatics, because in perturbation theory you have to go there and come back, and normal Van der Waals does not screen. Okay, so it's a 1/r^6, but it's not at all what we think of as the Van der Waals. One of them goes by the Debye, I think there's the Debye interaction, and then this one is sometimes called the Keeson interaction. And the third one is Van der Waals.
Oh, so I don't know if you talked about what is limiting this model, but since we discretize space, there should be degrees of freedom that are not explored. For example, charges moving around inside one box.
Well, there you have interpolation methods, and you have these correction methods, where clearly there's you're losing some information. If your grid is too coarse, then you can't do it. So there's always a. But this, I would have hesitated a lot. I'd have said, well, this is a real physicist thing, and no one is going to like this. But the biologists already do this. Many of the people doing the big simulations use routinely these grids every day, and they're quite happy with it, and they claim accuracies of 10^-8 in the energy using these grids, because they've got very sophisticated interpolation methods and correction methods.
Just for real structural problems?
Yeah.
Not
in molecular dynamics, they use it in molecular dynamics. So they have their particles, they interpolate to the grid, mm-hmm. They use the Poisson equation in FFT to solve the electrostatic problem, that gives them the force, they move their particles again, so on and so forth. So at every time step, you solve the Poisson equation.
One nice thing about this method is because it is a Monte Carlo method. You can get much smarter if you want about how you relax the field. That is, so I'm worried about maybe there's some. Well, I guess there are two problems. One is that if you want to do a very fine grained grid, then with a relatively loop charge, then you have to relax a lot of field in space, in empty dimensions in space. But and if that diffuses, if that is a diffusive dynamic, it's also somewhat slow.
Yeah.
But there are, I think, among others, multi-grid methods for speeding up diffusion. And you can use all the trickery.
I think it opens a lot of doors, and that there are probably many tricks that will and can be played in the future. And that certainly opens I think it's a fun problem in terms of applying this mechanics to a real problem, which is not an, it wasn't an experimental problem this time, but I think there's still some interesting things to do.